And welcome back. This is episode 19 of The Daily Buddhism, and I'm your host, Brian Schell. I don't have too much in the way of announcements this week, but I do want to point out a few quick things. Monday is a holiday, here in the States anyway, and I'll be out of town, so there won't be a daily email on Monday. Secondly, not much has changed as far as donations are concerned since last week, but I'm not going to keep harping on it. Okay, third thing. This is already episode 19 of the show. Wow. Seems like we've only got just started. The good news is that I have material to continue for pretty much forever. The bad news is that all the audio shows cannot stay available online forever. Between web hosting space and, more importantly, bandwidth issues, I'm going to have to start taking down some of the oldest shows starting next week. I hope to be able to leave the last 15 weeks or so of audio shows online at a time. So each week as I add a new show, I'll take off one from way back. So my recommendation for right now is that if you don't already have all the back episodes of the show, you should find the ones you don't already have and download them now where they're still available. Remember, we started out with episode 0 for an introductory show, and now we're on 19. I guess that means this is actually the 20th episode. Number just keeps going up. And you can find them all here at www.dailybuddhism.com/archives/category/podcasts. That will list nothing but the podcast shows. And now, on with this week's show. And most of this week's activity came from my responses to your emails. So if you do have any questions on anything at all, questions, comments, or anything else, email me at dailybuddhism@gmail.com or put your comments on at the blog at www.dailybuddhism.com. Monday's email came from a reader who said, I was born and raised a hellfire and brimstone Baptist. My grandfather was a Southern Baptist preacher, and I literally grew up in church. By the time I was in my teens, I had begun to question my upbringing and have finally been able to break the bonds of my teaching and am now trying to follow the Buddhist way. My deeply religious family did not know of my conversion, and it's easier for me to practice my Buddhism as I live in the Southwest and they are in the Midwest. I have a question, however, regarding rebirth and karma. If a person follows another religion, I assume that they are still subject to accumulating karma and experiencing rebirths until they, too, reach enlightenment. Is this a correct assumption, even though the person may think that their religion is the only true religion and the rest of us are pagans destined to an eternity in their Christian hell? Thank you for your daily emails and weekly podcasts. For beginners like myself, they have been extremely educational and insightful. And my response to that was, yes, what you said is exactly correct. It doesn't matter what another person believes. If karma and rebirth are the way the universe actually works, then religious belief is not going to lock you into damnation or anything of that sort. Everyone's thoughts and actions raise or lower their karma. Christians or Wiccans or atheists or fill in blank here can still accumulate positive karma. Buddhists obviously believe that their way is the best and will lead to full enlightenment and escape from the cycle in the most expedient way. Can non-Buddhists ever actually escape from the cycle of rebirth? Well, I can't answer that for a fact, obviously, but Buddhist doctrine would say that reaching that point is extremely difficult. Very few, even the best Buddhists, make it. I guess it's theoretically possible for a non-Buddhist to achieve enlightenment. After all, the original Buddha wasn't a Buddhist until he started it. But I doubt it's common or even likely. That being said, I see no reason why a good Hindu, Muslim, Christian, or whatever cannot achieve a good rebirth through good works and a good life. Maybe they'll pick up Buddhism next time around. If others think you are wrong, they may tell you you're going to hell for your beliefs. If you think they are the ones in the wrong, you can only tell them they're going to have to come back for another chance. Which is more compassionate in your eyes? Then, on Tuesday, we covered one more reader comment on the Great Intoxication debate from last week, and then I think we're going to let that subject go for a while, at least until it comes up again. Somehow I doubt we've really resolved that one. But a reader recently wrote, "Brian, first of all, thank you for the huge effort you've been putting into this. As to my 2 cents worth on this, I agree with Kimberly," another commenter on the blog, "that it's about the third way, whatever that is, and while I agree that personally you cannot go wrong with abstinence. This is not necessarily true in social situations where refusal to imbibe may cause hurtful or offense in the same way as refusing food or gifts. It's not for me to judge what is right or wrong. It is for me to avoid doing harm, and if this means having a glass of wine or beer, so be it." From other Buddhist lectures on this topic, I've taken away the impression that this precept addresses exactly your worry. Gateway drugs that start you on the slippery slope, and the idea is perhaps, don't even lead me into temptation. Most things we do have some kind of drug effect on us. Our body produces its own opiate derivative, endorphins. They can be released through a variety of things, exercise, sex, food. So my understanding of the precept is to avoid heedlessness and realize that to stay on the middle way, we need to know what our boundaries are. And I can't argue with that, and I think that is where we're going to leave that discussion for a while. And Wednesday brought another letter from a user. A reader wrote in, "Often as I read English language Buddhist resources, I am bombarded with terms from Pali, Tibetan, and Sanskrit. Perhaps it would be more helpful if Buddhist teachers translated as accurately as possible the various Buddhistic terms into English or whatever language needed for the culture, rather than expecting the practitioner to keep a vocabulary list going. Since clarity is beneficial, and if Buddhism really is adaptable, then using one's own language in its study should not be a big deal. I'm not trying to be Anglo-centric, but it seems like we all lay it on thick sometimes. When I was involved in the Southern Baptist Church, many pastors would often revert to Greek or Hebrew words from the Bible in an apparent effort to gloss over a difficult passage for the congregation. We should be able to communicate Buddhism clearly in any language without reference to its antecedents. Plus, I feel like some beginners may attach to an idea that may be verbalized as follows. Wow, this Buddhism is really cool because it uses Asian words, of which I am unfamiliar. That means it's special because of the words, rather than the concepts behind the words. Sometimes you can almost hear the condescension when a teacher begins to pour out these words. I know Pali, what a good boy am I. It's just something to think about. Buddhism is a philosophy that transcends continental boundaries. So should its concepts and linguistics." Wow, what a great letter. But my response is that I get that impression a lot, too. Some people and groups act like the words themselves have some kind of power. I'm not sure if I've related this story here yet or not, but the only local Sangha, Buddhist church, nearby here in Dayton, Ohio, is a Tibetan group. They chant in Tibetan every week. The chants are printed on little cards with phonetic sounds printed on them. They just read the sounds, and eventually they memorize these chants. Why? No one there is actually Tibetan, and I bet my bottom dollar that very few of the attendees can translate. What is the point of that? Last week, I used the phrase, mystical mumbo-jumbo. But that's not the same thing as simply using too much jargon. Obviously, I agree with this letter completely on this, and I've tried to keep the big words to a bare minimum here. When I introduce a topic, I also tell you the term that accompanies it, but if I use that idea later, I try not to assume the reader or listener knows it. Lots of people are new to the mailing list, or haven't heard all the audio shows, or wherever they're getting this information from me. Why assume that the reader knows all the terms? For the most part, Buddhism is made up of many relatively simple concepts. Why get all bogged down in terminology? That being the case, I think the Daily Buddhism website probably should have some kind of glossary of terms. I've introduced some of the jargon already. Words like karma, Anatman, Dharma, Mudras, and the like. There are some concepts where it's just easier to use the common word. It's not hard to learn the difference between Dharma and Karma. Still, it probably wouldn't hurt to have one easy place to refer to all these terms, so I'm going to start adding a list and get something posted soon. Call it the Daily Buddhism Glossary or something. That's a project coming up soon that I'm going to work on. In the meantime, if anyone has come across any terms, concepts, or jargon that they'd like me to help explain, then send it in. dailybuddhism@gmail.com. Then we moved on to this week's story, the koan, the moon cannot be stolen. Ryokan, a Zen master, lived the simplest kind of life in a little hut at the foot of a mountain. One evening, a thief visited the hut, only to discover there was nothing to steal. Ryokan returned and caught him. "You have come a long way to visit me," he told the prowler, "and you should not return empty-handed. Please take my clothes as a gift." The thief was bewildered. He took the clothes and slunk away. Ryokan sat naked, watching the moon. "Poor fellow," he mused. "I wish I could have given him this beautiful moon." And then on Thursday, we got into a topic that I really like. This one surprised me. A reader recently wrote, "I have what is probably a really dumb question. I'm attempting to follow a vegetarian lifestyle. I also share my home with 3 cats and 2 dogs and 1 foster cat. I'm a big animal activist. But doesn't the purchase of pet food, which is made out of animal byproducts, go against the right action precept? What, in general, are the Zen beliefs on pet ownership, for lack of better terms?" And my response to that? Dumb question? No way. This is actually very interesting, and nowhere near as simple as it may sound. I couldn't find anything in writing on the subject, so all that follows is just my logical stream of thought on this. I could well be wrong, or taken in the wrong line of reasoning. I'm going to guess that others are going to chime in on this topic on the blog. Now, we have discussed vegetarianism here in the past. Different groups have differing opinions on the topic. I think pretty much everyone agrees that in theory, vegetarianism is the best way to go. But most groups do not require it, not even for monks. That's not really your question, but I wanted to point that out in case people needed to refer to that. But now, your dogs and cats are meat eaters, so feeding them requires some other animal to be killed. Now, my understanding of your question is whether or not buying meat for your pets is a bad thing. Now, many Buddhists believe that people with negative karma are reborn as dogs. Dogs are not intelligent enough to raise their karma on their own, so they essentially have to remain dogs until their negative karma has worn off. Eventually, they'll get another chance to become human again and can work on reaching nirvana. I think the important idea to get from this is that karma doesn't work the same way for animals as it does for people, because they are not able to affect their own karma, at least not to any great extent. Some animals, such as cats and dogs, are carnivores by nature. Meat eaters. They cannot survive on a vegetarian diet. They just can't. They eat meat because they have to. It's the way of things. There's no negative connotation or bad karma involved when a cat kills a mouse. It's just in the nature of the animal. If you were not in the picture, and the animal lived out in the wild on its own, it would kill and eat meat on its own, oblivious to karma, Buddhism, or any of the high ideals that humans have. Now, it is true that by buying dog food, you are paying someone to kill animals. This, taken by itself, is a bad thing. However, if the pet food makers did not kill the animals, your animals would be doing it themselves. Either way, a food animal dies. Now, this seems to me to be a zero-balance situation, and the net karma would be unchanged. The animal is going to die either way. Therefore, I'm going to say that pet food is probably a karma-neutral situation. Also, keep in mind that by treating your pets well, you're increasing your own karma, and the positive psychological effects of pet ownership probably affects your own karma as well. Pet ownership overall is a good thing for a Buddhist. Now, I can see where this could be argued several different ways, so this is definitely not the only way to view the subject. But it's the way I'm going to go on this. Check the blog to see what other people have commented. I know we're going to get comments on this one. And now it's time for this week's chapter of the Dhammapada. This week we're going to do chapter 3, all about thought. Chapter 3, Thought. As a fletcher makes straight his arrow, a wise man makes straight his trembling and unsteady thought, which is difficult to guard, difficult to hold back. As a fish taken from his watery home and thrown on dry ground, our thought trembles all over in order to escape the dominion of Mara the tempter. It is good to tame the mind, which is difficult to hold in and flighty, rushing wherever it listeth. A tamed mind brings happiness. Let the wise man guard his thoughts, for they are difficult to perceive, very artful, and they rush wherever they list. Thoughts well guarded bring happiness. Those who bridle their mind which travels far, moves about alone, is without a body, and hides in the chamber of the heart, will be free from the bonds of Mara the tempter. If a man's thoughts are unsteady, if he does not know the true law, if his peace of mind is troubled, his knowledge will never be perfect. If a man's thoughts are not dissipated, if his mind is not perplexed, if he has ceased to think of good or evil, then there is no fear for him while he is watchful. Knowing that this body is fragile like a jar, and making this thought firm like a fortress, one should attack Mara the tempter with the weapon of knowledge. One should watch him when conquered, and should never rest. Before long, alas, this body will lie on the earth, despised, without understanding, like a useless log. Whatever a hater may do to a hater, or an enemy to an enemy, a wrongly directed mind will do us greater mischief. Not a mother, not a father will do so much, nor any other relative. A well-directed mind will do us greater service. And that's it for this week's episode of The Daily Buddhism. Stop in at www.dailybuddhism.com to read back issues, download old shows, or to comment on anything you've heard here. You can also sign up for our daily email list. Or if you'd like, check out one of our related podcasts, www.taooftheday.com, for Tao Te Ching daily reading. That's available either audio or text, depending on whether you want to go to the website or download the podcast. And my other podcast is Arcane Tales at www.arcanetales.com, where we cover classic horror, science fiction, and mystery stories. Until next week, then, see you next time.